Hello and welcome to the Lannan Centre podcast. I'm Aminata Fauna, Director of the Lannan Centre at Georgetown University. In this episode, you'll hear writer and Whiting Award winner Tope Fularin read from his debut novel, A Particular Kind of Black Man, and later discuss the ideas contained in the book on inspiration, identity and narrative. Hello. And welcome to the final Lannan Centre reading of this, the full semester. Please take a moment to quiet your phones. Tonight's reading will be followed by a short conversation with the author, and then we'll open up to questions, so please have yours ready, and don't be shy. There'll be roving mics, and this event is being live streamed and recorded, so please be sure to use one. Thank you to Paddy Guzman and Derek Engen for organising tonight's event. Tope Fularin is the inaugural visiting Lannan lecturer in creative writing. He was educated at Morehouse College and Oxford University. In 2013, he won the Kane Prize for African Writing, which came with a fellowship to the Department of English at Georgetown. So he's been a long-standing member of this community. Tope Fularin is the author of A Particular Kind of Black Man, published in 2019, and which was a Time magazine, Washington Post, Vulture, and New York Times' most anticipated title. The Times Review later stated, "Fularin is attentive to the ways in which mental illness and the particular crises of poverty, immigration, and blackness can dovetail, and how communal silence and shame can magnify one rupture into many." In April this year, Tope Fularin won the 2021 Whiting Award for Fiction. Please extend a welcome to Tope Fularin.
It is truly, truly wonderful to be here. I've been looking forward to this reading for quite some time, and thank you so much for that introduction, by the way, Aminata. Really appreciate it. I can't help but think about like the role that Georgetown has played in my trajectory. As Aminata mentioned, I had the great privilege of winning the Kane Prize in 2013, and one of the great sort of gifts that accompanies that prize is an opportunity to come to Georgetown. I'd been living in D.C. at that point for maybe about 8 years, and I don't think I'd ever been on campus. And I was at a place in a novel where I was struggling to land the plane. I'd written so much, and I was trying to get my head around all these words I'd written, and it was incredibly difficult. And I had the gift of being able to have a desk and a room here, and I basically stayed there when I wasn't visiting classes and wrote as much as I could. And I basically finished at least the first draft of my novel when I was here. So Georgetown has been important to me, and Lannan has been important to me. So it's incredibly sort of wonderful to have this full circle moment, especially in this room that in so many ways resembles Oxford, which also plays an important role in my life. I'm in the middle of writing my second book right now, which is, it's been a journey. And in the process of doing that, I've been thinking a lot about how I came to be a writer in the first place, why it's something that is so deeply important to me, why I can't seem to shake this compulsion, this impulse to commit pen to paper. And I was writing a scene a few days ago. Much of my fiction, as some of you may know, is rooted in my own life. And I was able to kind of excavate a memory that I hadn't interacted with in quite some time. When I was growing up in Utah, my parents are both from Nigeria. And when I was younger, my mother had to go back to Nigeria because she became ill. And so my dad was in the process of juggling like four jobs, sometimes even more. He had like three jobs that he went to, and he was hustling on the side. He was doing all kinds of things. And one practice that he adopted was that he would take my brother and me to the library, especially on the weekends in the morning, drop us off and pick us up when he was done. And so we became very close with the librarians. And I'm not sure if this was intentional or not, but we became sort of really committed to books. We became obsessed with books. And I began to kind of sort of rebel against my father in the setting as well. My father was convinced that if we were to do well in America, we had to read only biographies, biographies of great men, he would say. If you want to be great, you have to read a biography of a great man. So he would go to the librarian and instruct the librarian that, okay, today, you know, Tope has to read about the life of Abraham Lincoln, and he has to read about the life of, you know, Booker T. Washington. And so on. And then the moment he left, the librarian would wink at me. And then she'd pull off like a big science fiction tome and hand it to me, and I'd wink back and go and read it. And I think it's so funny that like sort of my, I love to read, but I was still in that phase where I wanted to kind of rebel against my father, and I did so by reading science fiction. And science fiction became incredibly important to me. And I read so much when I was younger, and it was also important to me because I was in a place where I was trying to come up with a sense of self. I was trying to define myself. And that was so incredibly difficult because, as I mentioned before, my parents are from Nigeria. I was born and raised in this country. I was born and raised in Utah, of all places. Utah is a lovely place. I just had an opportunity to go there a couple weeks ago. But I had no sense or definition of what it meant to be Black in America. My parents told me all the time that you were a Nigerian living in this country. And the people I interacted with outside of my home said, oh, you're an African American. And I had no idea what that was. And so books, I began to, I think, piece together a sense of self by reading so much, and especially by reading those fantasy and science fiction novels that I was so attached to. I would often see myself in the protagonists of these books, you know, the people who are slaying dragons or commandeering a spaceship and sort of conquering some alien race. For me, it became very important because at the same time that I was in this space of trying to define myself and get a sense of who I was, something that I could project out into the world, I was being told, I think, by many people around me that I was not as important, I was not as American as they were. And reading these books, I think, enabled me to find a sense of self, even if I was finding that self in really strange circumstances. So reading became a core part of who I was. I read a lot when I was in elementary school, on to middle school. By the time I get to high school, my dad, because he was always chasing some job, he would move. We moved every 3 years. I never stayed in a place more than 3 years. And I remember when I was a sophomore in high school, I was probably at my lowest point in terms of the way I thought about myself and my sort of the way I thought about my trajectory, the way I thought about my prospects. And we had just moved to another school, to another town, and so I was in another school. And I remember going into the library, and that was the first place where I went. I didn't go to my class. I went to the library. I skipped my first class. And the librarian sort of, I guess she saw that I was struggling, and she sat me down, and she asked me what was going on. I told her a bit about my life and the things that I'd experienced. And then she went to the bookshelf and pulled down a book called The Bluest Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison, which I never heard of Toni Morrison before. I never heard of this book. And I took it home. And it was really my first time reading a book that wasn't sort of obsessed with orcs and, you know, spaceships and warp drive. And I took the book home. And it really, I think, in many important ways changed the course of my life because I'd assumed up to that point that I was the only person who, like, truly reviled myself. For many years, I was afraid to look in the mirror. I'd been taught, I think much of my childhood that, you know, because I was not a European, because I didn't kind of resemble a European, that something was fundamentally wrong with me. And I had ingested that line, that belief wholesale. And I was also convinced that I was like one of the few people, perhaps the only person in the world who was kind of deeply ashamed of myself and deeply ashamed of the way I was in the world and deeply ashamed of the way that I looked. I'll never forget cracking open that book and reading about Pakola Breedlove, who's the character in that book who wants blue eyes. And I could relate so deeply to that because I wanted blue eyes. I wanted certain features I didn't have. And I think reading that book convinced me of a couple things. One, that I wasn't alone, and that was deeply meaningful to me. And two, that literature could be a way of drawing connections between people in completely different parts of the world, across time as well. I never had the chance to meet Miss Toni Morrison, but her words across time impacted me greatly. And so I started reading more Morrison and digging my way into Baldwin and Ellison and folks that I hadn't read before. And my dad, you know, like any sort of enterprising immigrant, was also in a place where he was reading like crazy as well. And he was trying to start a business. And as he was in the process of trying to start this business, and he did this actually when I was even younger, before I was in high school, when I was about 9 or 10, he would often insist, he would buy a book, for example, about starting a business. And then he would read it, and then he'd give it to me and say, you know, you should read this as well, because we need to figure out together how to start this business. And so I felt empowered because my father was including me in his plans of world domination. And it's a process that he continued when I was in high school as well. I was always having these intense conversations with my father about life, about how to project myself into the world. And these were all derived from books, because my father, in his own way, was quite an avid reader as well. And so one of the things that my dad had done when I was very young was that he didn't allow us to watch much television, and he curated our television experiences. And there were two films that he was quite fond of when I was growing up that he made us watch over and over again. One was about the life of Booker T. Washington, who, in effect, once he learned how to read, read his way through many libraries, and kind of acquired this incredible education by committing himself to the process of reading as much as he could. And that left an impact on me, and that was something I aspired to do in my own life as well. The second movie was about Morehouse College. It was a movie about, I think, a few seniors at Morehouse. And they were just, for me, this was a vision. It was incredible. These men were all articulate. They were all confident. They were all had big ambitions for their lives. And looking back, I know precisely why my dad wanted me to watch this, but I think something unexpected happened, because like most immigrant parents, my father wanted me to go to a school like Georgetown or an Ivy League school. He was insistent on it. And of course, he conditioned me. I watched this film so many times that I was convinced that Morehouse College was the school for me. And so by the time I was a senior in high school, I told him in no uncertain terms that I was going to Morehouse. And he was deeply disappointed, because if any of you here are the sons or daughters of immigrants, you likely know that immigrant parents live to brag to other immigrant parents about what their kids are doing. That's their only purpose in life, it seems. And, you know, so I know my dad was participating in conversations in which his friends were saying, oh, my daughter, and Nigerian parents in particular, brag a lot and are very arrogant. So I'm sure he was feeling the pressure from his clan of fellow Nigerian immigrants. But I told him, again, I was going to Morehouse. And by the time I get to Morehouse, I had fixed in my mind, I had this really dramatic experience with my father right before I got to college. I graduated from high school. My dad never came to events for me. He came to my high school graduation, and it was a great graduation. I did pretty well in my class. I sang a lot when I was in high school, so I sang the school song at the graduation. As I'm walking down the steps, my dad looked at me and he said, I'm so disappointed in you. You should have graduated first in your class. And he turned on his heel and walked away. And we didn't talk for a while after that, because I was so upset with him. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, he's right that I should have pushed myself more, that I should have done more, you know, to kind of do well in high school. And so when I got to college, I was obsessed with the Ring of Time series The Will of Time series by Robert Jordan. And I was making my way through these novels. I was reading every page. And by the time I got to Morehouse, I spent my first night reading through book two of that series. And then I had this thought in the middle of the night. I thought, you know, like, this is what prevented me from doing as well in high school, this fact that I was, like, reading too many books about, you know, stuff that wasn't directly related to my studies. And so I had this ceremony where I threw the book away, and I told myself that I would not read any piece of fiction unless it connected in some way to my studies. And I sat down and I wrote a list of 10 things I wanted to achieve by the time I finished college. And then I wrote another list of 10 things that I'd have to give up if I wanted to achieve that first list. And top of that second list was, I have to stop reading frivolous novels. And so for much of my college career, and I think I did this as well because I knew that I had this creative impulse, and I was trying my best to kind of push it away because I was afraid that it would drag me under. And like, you know, many children, like many sons and daughters of immigrants, my dad had instructed me that I was to go off to college and then either become an engineer or a doctor or an attorney. And so I felt those were the only pathways to success. And I was trying my best to fend off this impulse, this desire to be creative. And so I got, you know, I was committed to that. I stopped reading novels. I did pretty well in school. And then at the end of my college career, I was kicked out of school for financial reasons because I had gone to South Africa for a semester, had come back. They had somehow lost my papers. And so I was watching a film called Malcolm X, directed by Spike Lee. And at the end of that film, there's this wonderful roll call where he sort of highlights all the people who funded the film. So it's a who's who of prominent African Americans. You have, you know, athletes and stars and singers and all kinds of people. And as I was watching the film, I thought to myself, well, I'm in this really desperate position. I'm living on my friend's couch. I'm doing well in college, but there's a real chance that I might not graduate from college. And why not write, you know, everybody that's being featured here? I'll write all of them, tell them what my predicament is, and maybe at some point one of them will sort of reach out and help me out. And so I wrote dozens of letters, you know, to everybody and other people who weren't featured in this part of the film. And 2 weeks later, I got a call from the administration office, and they told me that Oprah Winfrey had paid for my senior year of college. And so, and that she also wanted to have a conversation. And so maybe a couple months after that, we had the conversation. And this was also important because, you know, as she does, she asked me, what do you actually want to do with your life? And it was the first time I'd kind of reckoned with that question for quite some time because, again, I was trying to condition myself into somebody who could do well in life. And that meant that I couldn't sort of read novels that weren't connected to my life. And that meant that I had to be really studious. And that meant I had to get straight A's. That meant that I had to do all these things. And I thought about it for a moment. And I thought, you know, I'm an artist, you know. It was like, it was a revelation. It was, for me, akin to kind of opening the door and all this light kind of beaming into my face, like this is what I was supposed to be doing. And so I carried that with me when I went to Oxford. And Oxford was great because unlike the tertiary system here in the States, you have all this time to yourself. You know, I basically would only have to go to one tutorial every week, which basically consisted of me sitting down with, you know, some really erudite, you know, person who had been at Oxford for many, many years and reading my essay out loud to this person and then getting sort of, and then him sort of dissing my essay in all kinds of ways and going back and trying to make the essay better. And so that was basically my one commitment. There were lectures that I could attend and everything else, but I opted not to. And instead, I set out for myself this process of I was afraid to admit it to myself, but I knew I was kind of trending in that direction. So I said, I'm going to find all the first novels that I can, all the debut novels by writers I admire, and I'm going to make my way through them. I'm going to get my notebook and write what, you know, appeals to me about these novels and why they work and why they don't work for me. And so I had a stack of novels by my bed. I wish I would have brought I have a picture of all these books by my bed. And me kind of lounging in my bed. And I read my way through all these novels. And at the end of the year, I decided that I would try to start the process of writing a novel, which was, you know, now I recognize it's a somewhat foolhardy thing to do, but I thought I have the formula, I know how to do it. So my second year, I did a master's in African studies. And I also spent a lot of time working on my first horrific novel. But it was a really great process for me because it was the first time that I committed myself. Because for me, the big barrier was, first of all, can I write something that's 10,000 words long? Can I write something that's 20,000 words long? Can I write something that a typical novel, they say, is 80,000 words? Do I have enough material to get there? And so over the course of my second year at Oxford, every night after I'd finished doing whatever it was I was supposed to do for school, I'd try to write 1,000 words on this piece that I was working on. And I was so proud of myself because at the end of the year, I had this 80,000 word monstrosity on my hard drive that was something of a novel, which is to say it had a beginning, it had an end, it had a kind of through line. And I was so proud of myself as I read through it, and I thought, you know, this is the beginning of literary fame and fortune. I sent this thing everywhere. Of course, it was rejected out of hand everywhere. And so I was in a place where I had to figure out what I was going to do with my life because I had been convinced I'd publish a novel before I left Oxford, and that didn't happen. And so I decided at this point that I would start working at Google. And Google is a very interesting place because it's a really tough place to get into. I had 7 interviews on 2 continents, and I got through these interviews. And at the end of the process, when they're about to hire you, they say, okay, this might not be the case anymore, but when I worked there, they said, okay, we have this policy called 20% time. You can do whatever you want for 20% of your time. And what would you like to do for your 20% time? And I said, I'd like to work on a novel. And they said, fine. And I thought, how much can I push this? And I said, well, I'm really into reading Russians. I'd like to learn Russian so I can read Russians in the original Russian. And they said, fine, that's great. And I said, I want to spend some time in Moscow as well. They said, that's cool, you can do that. And so I was like, you know, this is great. And I went to Moscow on my sixth day at the office and spent about 4 or 5 days there. I didn't learn a lot about literature. I learned a lot about other stuff, which I probably shouldn't say on a live stream, but it was a really interesting experience. And I started learning Russian, and I have to say I'm the worst sort of Russian language student in the history of the world. I couldn't get, I was very bad with the Cyrillic, but again, I was committed to this process of becoming as good a writer as I could and reading the Russians and reading the great novels they'd written. And Google also gave me some money so I could start a library. And so I started like sort of curating this personal library and buying titles and storing them away. And my second year at Google, they gave me this great bonus. And I thought, okay, this is what I've been waiting for. I can finally leave. I'm going to go back to the States, spend 6 months finishing up this second novel that I've been working on. Then I'll get back into the workforce. And so I came, it was 2008. And I worked on the book for a couple of months. And then the financial crisis happened. And basically, I was out of work for 18 months. And this was, I thought at the time, the worst moment of my life, because I had done everything in my power to avoid this kind of conclusion, to avoid this possibility that I would be, unemployable, that I wouldn't get a job. And I was living here in D.C. in a small apartment. I had nothing to do. And I thought, okay, so what can I do with myself right now? I was dejected and beside myself. And I thought, well, I can begin to structure my day. I had been reading a lot of Susan Sontag, especially her journals. She talks a lot about how she kind of created for herself an atmosphere of artistic excellence by engaging with every book that she could, going to as many museums as she could, watching as many films as she could. And I thought, I'm in the perfect place to do that. And so I started going to the museum every day for 2 or 3 hours. I started going to every reading I could. I came, you know, I went to Politics and Prose in town, Kramer Books. I went to all these places every day. You know, there's somebody there every day. And I wrote for hours every day as well, and I watched movies, and I did this for a year and a half. And looking back, I can say without any hesitation that that was the most important period of my artistic life, because it was this. I had this process of really committing to the life of an artist in a way that I probably wouldn't have otherwise. If I had come back to the States and gotten a great job, I imagine that I would have remained committed to the dual track of trying to write and have a job at the same time. And the fact that I was away from the world and basically I was reckoning with myself forced me, I think, to kind of learn craft in a way that I wouldn't have otherwise. And so I, at the end of this period, I was fortunate enough to get a fellowship at a place called the Institute for Policy Studies, which is a progressive think tank here in town. And I was there for a year, and that's when I said, okay, I'm going to start trying to write a new novel. At the beginning of the year, started writing a novel that would become my debut novel, A Particular Kind of Black Man. And so I started writing that novel, writing this every single day. At the middle of the year, I was going to the West Coast for a fundraising trip for the Institute. They flew me out to California to try to meet some donors. And I found myself in this like palatial residence in San Francisco. And I was just, it was like a place where they have like two expensive wall, art on the wall, the kind of art that you typically only see in museums. And so they usher me to this like sort of grand table. And at the head of the table is somebody I'd admired for quite some time, Gore Vidal, who was at that point in a wheelchair. And I was like, I stood up to talk and I'm like, I don't want to talk in front of Gore Vidal. I really love him too much. I said whatever I had to say. And at the end, he came up to me and he said, I spoke a bit about what I was doing. And he was like, he said, and I'm paraphrasing him, but he said, you have to guard your life and your time jealously and do everything you can to finish that book, because if you don't finish it now, you'll never finish it. And so when I got back, I just thought, I have to finish the book by the end of the year. And I wrote and I wrote and I wrote. And I got to a place where I was sort of happy with it. And then I revised a few times over the course of the next couple of years. And then, of course, I won the Kane Prize after that and had the opportunity to come here to Georgetown and finish the book. And as I think about that journey, I can't help but think about just how important the process of fully committing to the life of an artist has been for me. And Georgetown, for me, has been a really critical component of that. So, again, it's truly wonderful to be here with all of you. It's truly wonderful to have a chance to read my work, and wonderful as well to have a chance to engage with Aminata. So I think I'll read a bit from the book and then look forward to having that conversation. She told me I could serve her in heaven. She accompanied me to school each day. School was about a mile away and a few hundred feet into my trek. Just as my family's apartment building drifted out of view behind me, she would appear at my side. I don't remember how she looked. Memory often summons a generic figure in her place, an elderly white woman with frizzled gray hair, slightly bent over, a smile featuring an assortment of gaps and silver linings. I do remember her touch, however. It felt cool and papery, disarmingly comfortable on the hottest days of fall. She would often pat my head as we walked together, and a penetrating silence would cancel the morning sounds around us. I felt comfortable, protected somehow in her presence. She never walked all the way to school with me, but her parting words were always the same. Remember, if you are a good boy here on earth, you can serve me in heaven. I was 5 years old. Her words sounded magical to me, vast and alluring. I didn't know her. I barely knew her name. But the offer she held out to me each morning seemed far too generous to dismiss lightly. In class, I would think about what servitude in heaven would be like. I imagined myself carrying buckets of water for her on streets of gold, rubbing her feet as angels sang praises in the background. I imagined that I'd have my own heavenly shack. I'd have time to do my own personal heavenly things as well. How else would I get to heaven? One day I told my father about her offer. We were talking about heaven, a favorite subject of his, and I mentioned that I already had a place there. I've already found someone to serve, I said. What do you mean? Dad smiled warmly at me. I felt his love. I repeated myself, Daddy, I'm going to heaven. And how are you going to get there? I told him about the old lady, my heavenly shack, the streets of gold. My father stared at me a moment, grief and sadness surging briefly to the surface of his face, and then anger. He leaned forward, stared into my eyes. Listen to me now. The only person you will serve in heaven is God. You will serve no one else. My father has told me many times that he settled in Utah because he didn't want to be where anyone else was. His cousins and siblings had left Nigeria for Athens, London, Rome, New York City, and Houston. My father wanted to be an American, but he also craved isolation, so he decided he would travel to a city in America he knew nothing about. He left Nigeria in 1979 after a school in Utah, Weber State University, offered him a place in its mechanical engineering program. His bride, my mother, accompanied him. They arrived in a country that bore little resemblance to the country they expected. My father, a devout fan of television shows like Gunsmoke and Bonanza, was disappointed when he discovered that cowboy hats were no longer in style. And he sadly stowed his first American purchase, a brown 10-gallon hat that he bought during a layover in Houston, in his suitcase and under his bed. Mom arrived in America expecting peace and love. She had fallen for the music of the Beatles and the Beach Boys as a high school student in Lagos while listening to the records that her businessman father brought back from his trips abroad. Though she had imagined a country where love conquered all, where black people and white people lived together in peace and harmony, Mom and Dad arrived instead in a place where there were no other black people for miles around, a place dominated by a religion they had never heard of before. But this was America, and they were in love. They moved into a small apartment in Ogden, Utah, and started a family. I came first in 1981, and my brother followed in 1983. Dad attended his classes during the day while Mom took care of us at home. Occasionally, she explored the city while pushing my brother and me along in a double stroller. Soon enough, we were all walking hand in hand. At night, my parents held each other close and spoke their dreams into existence. They would have more children. My father would start a business. They would become wealthy. They would send their children to the best schools. They would have many grandchildren. They would build their own version of paradise on a little slip of desert in a country that itself was a dream, a place that seemed impossible until they stepped off the plane, shielding the sun from their eyes, and saw for themselves the expanse of land that my father had idly pointed to on a fading map many years before. As I look back now, especially with the knowledge of what will come after, the rest of my life set in unflattering relief, I realize that my first 5 years were the most ordinary of my childhood. We moved frequently, but I can only remember joy. One of my favorite memories from this era, for some reason I'm chasing my brother around our apartment with a red crayon. When I catch him, I pin him against the wall and color each of his teeth red as he screams. My mother shrieks when she sees him. She thinks he's bleeding because of the red wax that's shining from his teeth. She laughs when I tell her that the blood isn't real. And then we all laugh and I allow my brother to color my teeth as well. Then we color Mom's teeth. She prefers lime green. Life flowed easily until we moved to Bountiful. We settled there because my father had found a job at an auto repair shop in neighboring Layton, and Bountiful was one of the few places close by with any affordable housing. My father couldn't find a job as a mechanical engineer anywhere in northern Utah, but he knew a bit about cars and he figured he would work as a mechanic until something better came along. My mother's illness began to reveal itself to us shortly after we moved into our two-bedroom apartment, a tiny place near the center of town with pale yellow walls and bristly carpet. Mom's voice, once quiet and reassuring, grew loud and fearsome. Her hugs, once warm and comforting, became cold and rigid. She stopped cooking for us. Sometimes my brother and I didn't eat until my father returned from work in the evening. She began to spend more time in her room, away from us. One morning, my brother shook me awake and told me that Dad was crying. I did not believe him. I didn't think such a thing was possible. We scrambled to the living room and saw Mom standing over Dad, her eyes boiling with rage. My father was naked. His clothes, now nothing more than torn rags, were arrayed haphazardly around the room. He was bleeding from a wound on his thigh, and his face was wreathed in a constellation of sweat and tears. My brother and I reached over to him, but Mom cursed at us. "Get the hell out of here!" I was terrified. I looked at Dad. His bottom lip was shaking. His teeth were red. "Yes, go," he said. "What are you waiting for? Go now." We ran. We hugged each other in the corner of our room. Moments later, my father began to scream. Over the course of the next few days, my brother and I witnessed the scene many times, my father cowering on the floor, my mother standing imperiously over him. He took her punishment whenever she descended into one of her moods, and afterward he would enter our room with a calm smile and tell us that Mom wasn't feeling like herself, but that everything would soon be okay. We tried our best to believe him. Before long, we realized the truth. After Dad left for work each morning, my mother locked herself in their room. She rarely interacted with us, but occasionally she opened the door and asked us to come inside. She asked us to stand in the corner of the room near the dresser. She pointed to various places in the room: her closet, Dad's desk, the empty space near her full-length mirror. She asked us if we saw it. "See what, Mommy? Don't you see that? What is wrong with you?" My brother and I glanced at each other. Was this a game? "Mommy, I don't see anything. Can we go now?" "No. Not until you tell me what it is doing there. Tell me why it won't leave." Sometimes my brother and I lied. We made up stories about what we saw, and my mother nodded sagely. Sometimes she disagreed with us and told us to look again. This could have been fun, but the wild look in my mother's eyes unsettled us. Sometimes she told us that we had to leave before they came to get us. "Something about this place isn't right," she'd say. "Not right at all." Then she'd pull up her covers, switch on the radio, and mutter herself to sleep. I started school on September 7, 1987, a few weeks before I turned 6. I was ecstatic because I'd spent much time watching the kids in my neighborhood trip past my bedroom window with books under their arms and bags on their backs like they were departing for another world. I dimly sensed that at school I could become something more than a brother or son, that each day I went, I would come back carrying knowledge that was mine alone. My father walked with me to school that first day. I remember the principal extending her hand when I met her. I shyly extended mine as well. And as we shook hands, she said, "We are very happy that you're here." It was in her eyes, the way she looked at me, like I was something scary and unknown. That's how I knew I was different. On the playground, all my classmates asked if they could touch my hair. I said, "Okay." Then Simon rubbed my skin and ran away crying to the playground attendant. "It won't come off," he wailed. "Why won't it come off?" I was too tired after school to ask my father any questions, too excited about everything I had just experienced. But the next day, after another kid rubbed my arm until it was raw, I asked my father why my hair was so kinky and why I couldn't wash the brown off my skin. He shook his head and frowned. He began talking about the importance of pride, the meaning of self-respect, but I didn't really understand what he was saying. As he spoke, I thought about the old lady I'd met a few hours before. That morning, Dad had hugged me at the door of our apartment and told me that I'd have to walk to school by myself because he had to work and Mom wasn't feeling well. I said okay, but I was afraid because school seemed so far away. As I walked to school, tentatively, nervously, she suddenly appeared, like I had dreamed her into existence. She told me her name was Mrs. Hansen, and she asked me what I was doing. I told her I was walking to school. She smiled. "I've never seen a little black boy around here before," she said. "Where are you from?" "I'm from here," I said. She laughed and placed a hand on my shoulder. She spoke as we walked, and I enjoyed hearing her voice, the gentle rise and fall of it, because it somehow seemed familiar to me. She asked me questions about Dad and Mom and my brother. She told me that she'd always wanted to go to Africa, but she had never had the chance. When we were about a block away from school, she looked into my eyes and patted my head. "I enjoyed speaking with you. You are a wonderful little boy." She blinked slowly and nodded. "Maybe one day you'll get to serve me in heaven. If you do, I promise you'll get everything you've ever wanted." The happiness I felt as I turned and ran to school, the sheer joy, is something I've been searching for ever since. I woke up that morning to my mother rubbing my hair. Mom was smiling down at me when I opened my eyes. She looked beautiful. She was dressed in her favorite outfit, a finely embroidered purple blouse covered by a flowing wrapper, a matching headdress hovering atop her small afro. She asked me to wake up my brother, and after hugging us, she asked us to get dressed. "Where are we going, Mommy?" I asked as I pulled on my pants. "On an adventure," she said, smiling widely. "Now hurry up so we won't be late." My brother and I moved quickly in the crisp darkness. We rushed into the living room when we were done, and Mom evaluated us in a single glance. "Go get your backpacks and pack some clothes as well." "Where are we going? I told you, on an adventure. What about Daddy?" Mom turned and glanced at the wall. "He's coming later, after work." "How about school?" I asked. I'd only been in kindergarten for a month. Mom gave me a half smile. "Don't worry, just get ready." We ran to our bedroom and packed our bags with assorted socks, underwear, shirts, and pants. After a few minutes, we returned to the living room. "All done," we yelled in unison. She laughed. "You guys were quick. Okay, now wait. Someone is coming to pick us up." We sat. My brother and I tried to blow smoke rings with the frosty air. Mom disappeared into her bedroom, and when she returned, she was dragging a rolling suitcase behind her. A few records were tucked under her arm. She had replaced her headdress with a large brown cowboy hat. I'd never seen her so happy in my life. Someone rapped on the door a few minutes later. Mom nodded at us. "Go ahead," she exclaimed. "This is part of the adventure." My brother and I raced to the door, but I got there first. There was a woman standing there. She had short red hair, and her freckles were so densely packed that I wondered how each one survived without space, without room to grow. "How are you?" she asked. "You are so cute. Are you ready to go?" Mom joined us at the door. "Yes, we are ready. Let us go before it is too late. We have so much to do today." We piled into the lady's car. I can't remember what kind of car it was, just that it was small, and that my mother insisted I sit in the front. The freckled lady turned the ignition and revved the engine while my mother held my brother close. The lady turned to me and asked if I was cold. I shook my head, but we sat in the dark until I felt the heat on my shoes and face. Then she put the car into gear and we drove off. We passed a local grocery store, Smith's, and I suddenly realized that we weren't going on an adventure. "Mommy, where is this woman taking us?" "I already told you. Now be quiet and enjoy the ride." "Mommy, I don't believe you. Where are we going? Where's Daddy?" Mom ignored me. The lady patted me on the head and turned on the radio. Stevie Wonder was singing something, but I don't know what it was. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tippi. Fabulous talk. Wonderful reading. probably one of the most dramatic writer origin stories I've ever heard.
I was going for the drama.
But I recognize a good bit of it, because especially the Nigerian parents thing. I mean, mine is certainly, background is Sierra Leonean, and I was supposed to become a lawyer. I got halfway down that track before I turned in a different direction. Talking of your father, is he proud of you now?
That's a great question. I think he is. I mean, he doesn't read fiction, as I think I kind of mentioned before. And he was really disappointed when I left Google. He was incredibly upset with me. And I remember he never said Google. He would always say Google. And he's like, "I can't believe you left Google. I'm so mad at you." And he didn't talk for a few months. And then he called me one day and he said, "What are you doing with your life? What's happening?" And I said, "Dad, I'm going to become a poet," because at that point I was writing lots and lots of poetry. And he just hung up the phone on me. He didn't talk to you. That was a desperate path. So we had this really fraught relationship for about a year and a half. And then I was fortunate enough to be shortlisted for the Kane Prize. And I went to London. And then I was fortunate enough to win. And there's this incredible moment, because it's sort of like it's a very, very, very small version of the Academy Awards, which is to say that you don't know who's going to win until the end. And so everyone's kind of munching on their nails and throwing stuff against the wall. And you're nervous and everything. And then they just kind of announced, Tope Fallaron. And I went up there and I gave this quick, frazzled speech, I'm sure. And somebody handed me a phone and said, you can make a phone call back home. And I called my dad. And my dad said, "I have been telling you your entire life to write. And now look what happened. I'm so proud of you, my son." So now he claims credit for, for my career.
So. I've actually judged the Kane Prize several times. Not the year you won, but several times. And I think the wonderful thing about that prize is that it is a bit of a game changer for the writer. Not all prizes have a big effect, but the Kane Prize certainly does seem to have a big effect, doesn't it? It is called the African Booker and for good reason.
It's an incredible thing. And I wish that, you know, it changed my entire life because before I was shortlisted for the Kane Prize, I had published one story in my life, a story called Miracle. And I wasn't even sure I was eligible for the Kane Prize. And a wonderful writer who works in the area named Helen Habila, I was in a place in my life where I was just desperate to get my work out there. And, you know, I used to co-host occasionally this radio show that would review books on WPFW. And what would happen was that the person who actually hosted the show, she would call me at my job if she had a guest that she knew I liked, and she would say, "Okay, I have so and so in the in the studio," and I tell my boss that I had to go home. There was an emergency. I had to run to the station. We do an interview and then run back to work. So one day she tells me that Helen Habila is there, and I'm like, "Okay, I'm gonna go." And I a couple of my friends were aspiring rappers or rappers who had made it, and they always had their their CDs on them, their mixtapes on them. And so I brought a couple of my stories. I'd been carrying my stories everywhere with me. And I gave one to Helon at the conclusion of the interview, and he rolled his eyes. I'll never forget, he's just kind of put his head back and rolled his eyes. And a few minutes later, I think he was in a metro, and he called me. He's like, "This is a good story. Have you thought about the Kane Prize?" And I hadn't, and I knew about it, of course. And he's like, "You should submit the story to the Kane Prize." And so I did. And then to go from sort of trying to get my stories into people's hands to winning the Kane Prize. And the day after the prize, I was at the BBC studio all day long. I was on a couple live shows. I was not dressed for the event. So I was like awkwardly reading my story on live television, to lots and lots of people. And then I get back. And, the funniest thing that happened was right before I left for London, I had been trying to get an agent. And I'd sent all these emails to all these agents. And they'd all rejected me really quickly. The last rejection I got was one that really hurt because I really wanted this, agent. And the first email in my inbox when I get back from London was from that agent. She's like, "I love the story. I'd love to talk to you." So I'm assuming somebody in the office, kind of just rejected it quickly. But it went from, zero to agents knocking down my door. And I traveled a lot the year following the Kane Prize. I went all over Africa, all over America, all over Europe. It was an incredible, so much so that I wasn't writing that much, so I had to buckle down.
Helen Habila won the Kane Prize, of course. Yeah. Binyavanga Wainaina won the Kane Prize, went on to found Kwani, which changed the face of Kenyan East African writing.
Yeah.
Now, here's a question I want to ask you. I got sent an advanced copy of your book, and so I went to my shelf to find it today in anticipation of this interview. And here it is.
Oh.
Only it has a different title.
Yes, it does.
It's called The Proximity of Distance.
Yeah.
Now, I'm the kind of person who remembers the author's name, not the title of the book. So what's... And I thought, have I just prepared an interview for a completely different book? And I thought, no, it was a debut novel.
Yeah.
So what prompted the name change?
Yeah, that was a title that I... As I mentioned before, I read a lot of poetry, and I came across that phrase... when I was reading, I think it was a poem by Tomas Tranströmer, though I could be mistaken, but he's one of my favorite artists ever. And I came across this phrase somewhere, and I thought, that's the title of my novel. And so it was in my head for a long time. And what happened was that the book was about to go, I guess, out to the printers. And the head of Simon & Schuster, Jonathan Karp, I never talked with him before. I don't know what happened, but he reached out to my editor and said, "This title is not going to work. I don't know what the book's about. I don't know, we need to rebrand it or something." I was really upset. And my editor said, "Okay, here's what we'll do. We'll just exchange, sort of titles all weekend. And at some point we'll come up with the right title." So, Friday night I'm going through the book. I send him a title. He's like, "No, this doesn't work." He does the same. We do this all weekend. And finally, I think it was Sunday morning, he's like, "What about A Particular Kind of Black Man?" And I thought, that's interesting. And it's a random phrase somewhere in the book. But I thought it did a good job of capturing what the book is about and the trajectory of the character. And it sort of includes some of his identity stuff as well. And so I thought, yeah, that makes sense. So it was really a matter of, I guess, marketing.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is, isn't it? Says what it does on the tin.
Yeah. In Britain. Exactly. This is what I'm getting into, right?
So let's talk a little bit about the origins of Tun Day. And by the way, everybody, I'm going to ask a couple of questions and then it's your turn. So, you know, be primed. The origins of Tun Day. So you told NPR you thought writers were talking mystical mumbo jumbo when they said characters take on a life of their own.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet Tun Day did. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, so when I started writing the book, I wasn't sure if I was writing like a novel or a memoir or something. And so I just thought I need to write. I want to write about a life that resembles mine, you know. And so I started writing. And actually, the character had my name for many drafts. But this weird thing started happening when I was writing, which was that, you know, and it feels weird to talk about it now, but like he had his own ambitions, his own aspirations. He did things that I never thought to do. He had thoughts that I don't think I've ever had. He had a crisis that I didn't have as well at a critical point in the book. And that's when it came to me. I thought like, wow, this weird thing that I, you know, kind of dismissed out of hand is happening to me now. And I have to say, you know, I had this process when I started writing of, I would go on YouTube and I'd watch all these writers talk about their process, talk about, you know, trying to write. And they all, almost to a person, would say, yeah, the character said this to me, and I thought, this is ridiculous nonsense. You know, this is irrational. There's no possible way this is happening. But I did begin to hear a kind of, you know, whispering, maybe sounds too melodramatic, but I did begin to have a sense of what this character wanted to do and how this character wanted to be in the world, if you will. And I think that's when I knew that I was actually writing a novel. And once I accepted that, it was much easier to write, because I think I'd been resisting that, because I thought, like, no, I want to write about how when I was, you know, 17, this happened to me and I had a crush on this girl, and the book wasn't going in that direction. So once I succumbed to that, you know, I think it was much easier to finish the book, I have to say.
I mean, characters, I mean, I write characters who are further distance from me than Tun Day was from you.
Yeah.
But there's absolutely no doubt that they follow me around like little children with good teeth.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they sit in the back of the car.
Absolutely.
On journeys.
Or waking up in the middle of the night. Yeah. It's happening all the time.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Did you get insomnia as a writer?
1,000%.
There we go.
Yes. And I would rush.
They wake you up.
Yeah. And I'd rush to the, you know, like, convinced that I had the most incredible thought that's ever.
Yeah,
and I'd write it down.
Yeah, it's the best
theoriously.
Ever.
Yeah. And then see it in the light
when
of day.
Properly awake. Like,
yes, exactly. First of all, illegible. Second of all, maybe not. But
talking about you and Tun Day, you do say, though, but the thing that unites us is the fact that we both have fragmented identities, or at least we did, and we're trying to come up with a way of melding these disparate pieces into a whole. And I'd like you to talk about that a bit, because beyond identity and the reimagining of the American narrative is our theme, the Lannan theme for the year and the subject of our forthcoming symposium. And, that quote really made me think, I mean, it's yours, of course, my quote, that quote really made me think, because Obama wrote when examining his own sense of identity, that he wasn't somebody who had an easy, off-the-peg identity. And I've often wondered since then, who really has an off-the-peg identity?
Yeah.
I mean, I often think that people... I get asked about identity a lot for obvious reasons,
imagine.
Because I come from two different countries, but it's not really a... It was never a vexing problem for me, and I think that's because of the era I grew up in. It wasn't the age of identity.
Yeah.
And also, we had a lot more going on.
Sure, other things.
Dictatorship and a war.
Absolutely.
And stuff. But I think about that phrase of Obama and the easy off-the-peg identity and, you know, how much, to what extent, I mean, obviously, Tun Day and you parallel yourself to this are trying to squeeze themselves into some kind of identity. But actually, isn't everybody, I mean, doesn't everybody have an identity that is more than one thing?
1,000%. And I think we're reckoning with that right now, which I think is one of the great things about living at this point in the 21st century, because we're acknowledging that fact. More people accept it. I grew up, I was a child in the 80s, kind of adolescent in the late 90s. And the one thing that I remember quite vividly about growing up is that I had the deep sense that, and I maybe would not have articulated it this way, but I had this sense that everybody had been handed an identity card upon birth, right? And growing up in Utah, this was even more... it was something that was, I think, more apparent because everybody went to the same church. The lives were organized around the Mormon church. So people had this very regimented life where they would wake up, they would go to school, they would have church activities, other kinds of activities. Their Mormon heritage was incredibly important to them. And in addition to that, Mormons and Utahns in general, sometimes some might say they're in one and the same, have a deep sense of patriotism as well. So I remember going into, we used to have these events called sing-ins at the beginning of our school day, where we would all gather in the auditorium and for like 15 to 20 minutes, we'd sing patriotic songs about America. That was how we started every school day. And then we go say the Pledge of Allegiance. And so there was this deep sense that like the Mormon lifestyle, the Mormon trajectory was a perfection of the American cause in a way. Like this is where Americans, this is how it's supposed to end up. And so I was exiled from all of that. I wasn't part of any of that. And so I think I acutely felt my sort of, the fact that I wasn't like that, the fact that I could, there was no possible way for me to be accepted into that. And even the pathways into that identity, it seemed to me meant sort of rejecting certain parts of myself, right? Like, so it's possible, for example, and this happened to certain members of my family, that you convert, become a Mormon, become part of the church, but then you would have to, I had the sense, and my father certainly had the sense, that you'd have to repudiate something important about yourself in the process. And so I think for me, it was growing up in that space that really forced me to reckon with, you know, questions that I'm sure others in my age range in other parts of the country perhaps didn't have to. And I think it made me sensitive too to the kind of deep importance of identity. I think what you said is really important, you know, because I had to consciously say, okay, who am I? Mm. What the hell am I? How do I go about building a sense of self that is coherent and makes sense? So much so that I remember, and I was looking back at pictures of me in high school, and I was like a walking contradiction. I was wearing like, you know, very preppy polo shirts and big baggy jeans. You know, I was like embodying in a way like my identity crisis, I suppose you could say. And I was trying to like, how do these fit together? How do I make everything kind of... when I got to Oxford, it was the first time I think that I was able to say, this is who I am. And I can proudly say that even if there isn't a kind of template that I can consult, you know, that this feels comfortable. And I think that was, and part of that was admitting to myself that I'm an artist, that I'm not going to go to law school, you know, that I'm not going to take the path. I think that became an incredibly important part of me reckoning with myself and coming to a conclusion about who I actually am. And hopefully as well, being sensitive to the journeys that other people are on, especially if it's off the beaten identity path.
One more question and then I'm coming to you. So that was your path to your own identity. And then I think really in your own narrative, and really this whole book is about narrative identity. It's about finding your identity through narrative. Mm. Thinking about America, the bigger picture, like a national narrative identity.
Yeah.
Your book, A Particular Kind of Black Man, actually is also, faces up to the myth of the American narrative, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, here's this family. They're the, I mean, Nigerians are the model immigrants, right? You know, they're the model immigrants. Here they come, and America doesn't deliver the dream, cannot deliver the dream. Could you talk to that a little bit?
Absolutely. I've long been intrigued by this American narrative because it, you know, prompted my parents to leave. My father in particular, what was a very comfortable life in Nigeria. Unlike many people who come to America, my dad wasn't under any kind of duress when he left. My grandfather was incredibly wealthy and well-positioned in Nigerian society, and my dad just had ambitions. He wanted to kind of make his own life, I guess, beyond the shadow was of his father, and that's the reason why he came to this country. I think the thing that I learned growing up was that my dad, you know, he's a really charismatic person. He's always like the loudest laugh. You know, he's glad handing people. He's very comfortable in spaces. In some other era on Earth too, he's a politician, you know, and he's very, very good at sort of, you know, being a big personality. But when I was growing up, I noticed that people were constantly mocking him. People couldn't see the greatness in him that I saw. And it's because he had a very thick accent, because he said words a certain way. And I was always flummoxed by that. I thought, why can't they see? Because again, when I heard my dad speak, I thought like, this sounds like a very wise person. And others heard something else. And that for me was dispiriting. And I think that was the beginning of, I guess you could call it a kind of political education. Because here's a situation where I believe deeply in the idea that if you worked incredibly hard, that everything would turn out okay. And I saw my dad working incredibly hard and things weren't turning out okay. And my dad conditioned my siblings and me to kind of become, in his eyes, perfect Americans. That meant from his perspective, like elocution lessons. He wanted us to speak a certain way. He wanted us to have perfect penmanship. He would, you know, critique the way we walked, critique the way we stood. And I think he had in his mind, like, if I had all these traits, if I had comported myself this way, things would be fine. The dark underbelly of that kind of conditioning, I think, is that it basically says that who you are is not good enough, that if you want to be successful, you have to become this other person. And that's the thing that I grappled with when I was growing up. So I think now, what's happening in America is a kind of really rigorous debate about the American character and what America actually is. And one could argue that this is a conversation we've been having since the founding of this country. But I think it's become more pronounced and perhaps even more profound because you have a bunch of people who are now for the first time saying, look, I have a problem with the way that, you know, my group has been depicted over the course of, you know, sort of years or centuries. And here's my rejoinder to that. And the dominant political class, the dominant class, you could say, has problems with that because they say, no, that's fine. And look, America's been great. And how dare you, you know, sort of respond and say that we've been depicting you in the wrong way or that we haven't given you the opportunities. And I think social media is a part of that. I think that the fact that more people of color have louder voices is a part of that as well. And so I think it's a situation where even, you know, people who are have good intentions, to be put it baldly, certain white people that might have good intentions are completely taken aback by the complaints that many other people are making about their position in American society. And I think it's about more voices being heard. And I think there's a recoil against that, as evidenced by all these images we see on television of people like yelling at school board meetings and critical race theory being twisted beyond whatever it actually is. It really is a question, it's a conversation about narrative. And even the conversation about the 1619 Project, for example, it's absolutely a big conversation because I think everyone recognizes that you are a narrative. We're all walking stories. And in addition to that, I'm the product of this story that's been winding itself through the years and my perception of that story. And so changing that perception means that I think you are changing the American character. And there are a lot of people who are completely happy with the way things are, and then will fight tooth and nail to ensure that that doesn't happen. And so, yeah, I think this is all a question of narrative. And I'm on the side of trying to change that narrative to have more space for more people.
Great.
Yeah.
All right. Shall we have some questions? Here's a question.
Yeah. I have a bit of a two-part question. The first half is sort of, how do you know when you are sitting on something good? And the second part of that question is, how do you sum up the sort of self-belief to keep pushing for that thing that you think is good, even if other people don't believe in it?
Ooh. Incredible question. I love it. Yeah, absolutely. The first part, I would say that for me, it was a matter of working my best to master craft, you know, because I knew that if I knew the craft of writing, if I was comfortable that what I was writing was solid from a craft perspective, that I would be fine, you know. So that what I did was I read a bunch of short stories, for example, when I started writing. And I would diagram the stories like, okay, what kind of structure are these writers employing? And I noticed that a bunch of my favorite writers employed a similar structure in writing their short stories. And so I started writing short stories using this structure. And then even when I kind of stepped away from it, I knew like the back of my hand precisely what, you know, a lot of writers were doing. And then when I moved on to novels, I would diagram the novels as well, which is a much harder thing to do, trust me. But I also saw some similarities in what writers were doing. I studied sentences. I studied images, metaphors, similes. What kind of, when is a metaphor sort of impactful? What about a metaphor makes it? And so I studied all these things. And so this took years of my life, to be honest. And after doing this for 2 or 3 years, I knew that I was a better writer than I'd been before. And I knew my stories were stronger. But that pair that with the fact that I knew I was writing about stuff that maybe wasn't so conventional. I had this experience when I started trying to sell the book, when an editor came back to me, and this is the dream call in a way. The editor came back to me and said, well, kind of a dream call, she said, gosh, I love the way you write Tope, it's incredible. But here's the thing, you know, I think that this story would be much stronger if you focus on the father character, if you write about him coming to America and his journey as an immigrant. What she was basically saying was that she wanted me to write another immigrant novel. And she said, you know, I think you have the pieces there, and we'd have to rework it a little bit, rejigger it, but you know, we can get that. I'd give you all the support, and here's the advance I would offer you. And in that moment, I thought, like, I've had a number of conversations with friends who are writers, and they've all told me that at some point the editor gets their paws on your work and changes stuff. And I thought maybe this is a version of that. You know, maybe this is what happens whenever you try to get a novel out into the world. But there was another part of myself that was screaming loudly, no, 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 this is not it. Don't do it. Don't take this deal because this is what you want to do. And perhaps there's stuff in the book that you have to make better. Perhaps there are other storylines that you have to excise, others that you have to add. But don't do what she's saying. And so I said no. And I was back in the wilderness for 2 years. No other editor would take on the book. I can say now from this vantage point, I'm incredibly happy that I made that decision. But in the moment, I remember like month 10, 11 of nobody biting the book and New York sort of ignoring me, all the publishing houses saying no, that I kind of went back and I thought, like, is this even good? And I knew the same voice said, no, you've done the work. You've done the work. The craft is there. It works the way you want it to. And it's just a matter of having faith, especially, I think, if as an artist you're trying to do something that hasn't been done before or something that isn't especially popular, especially if you're a person of color. Because the thing about being a person of color as an artist is that there are pathways to success. And I think many of us recognize those pathways. There are narratives that the kind of dominant class is accustomed to reading. And I think if you're willing to kind of put that narrative out into the world, there are all kinds of riches available. You know, conformity is lucrative in a way, right? But if you're trying to do something different, I think you have to kind of tell yourself that there will be some time in the wilderness, but continue to work on your skills, continue to try to become a better writer. And there's hope on the other end of that. I have to say, you know, when I got this call out of nowhere, out of the blue in February that I'd won the Whiting, I was like, what in the world? Like, it comes out of nowhere. In my case, I was like hanging out. I'd actually been talking with a colleague at my job who has a New York number, and we were having a conversation. And I, you know, and it cut off. And I saw the New York number. I was like, yeah, as I was saying, I kept on talking. And she was like, excuse me? And I was like, oh. And then she said, I'm calling from the Whiting Foundation to tell you you've won this. But the reason why that was important was because I had assumed that the book wouldn't get that kind of recognition because I knew that I was doing something different. I had insisted to the publishing house, for example, you know, like I want, you know, this to happen in the book and that to happen in the book. And it was just more than the prize itself. It was meaningful to me that people, I don't know who was on the panel. I don't know who, you know, selected the book, but I know that I'm sure that people who care about craft and care about the art of writing were a part of that process. And that means so much to me that people who have spent their lives working to become better writers and are incredible writers saw something of worth in a novel after this long journey of trying to get it out into the world. So that, I'd say just focus on the craft and, you know, everything will take care of itself.
Good advice. I'll take another couple of questions.
Sorry, I was just curious about your writing process and how that changed, like, during those different stages of your life.
Yeah, great question. I think the most important thing I did, and I say this to, you know, whenever I'm talking to other people who are trying to, you know, make it, I suppose you could say, as writers, the most important thing I did as a writer was that I spent 2 years of my life doing nothing but reading and writing poetry. Because that really, I think, I gained a much deeper appreciation for language and how it works on the page as a result of doing that. And that is by far the most important thing. I actually, every day, I start my day by reading a couple poems. It's a practice that I started back when I was in my mid-20s, and it's something I still do to this day. And I think poetry is important because it forces you to come to it, as opposed, like, I think of poetry is like a cat and prose is a dog, you know, like prose will come to you most of the time and sort of stick its tongue out and say, you know, take me seriously, whereas the cat chilling in the corner and says, come over and rub me, and I might look in your direction. Poems work that way. But there's something to be said about, like, the process of having to go to the language and reckon with the language on its own terms that I find incredibly important. So I think that was important. And then the thing that, when I started writing prose, that was important to me was just, again, I think I said before how difficult, I had this mental barrier of saying, like, I don't know if I can write, you know, a novel-length work. It just seems so long to me. And I just committed to the process of, like, writing 1,000 words a day, every day. And it became like jogging, which is something that I'm not the biggest fan of. But, you know, once you get into it, it's like, oh, if you don't jog, you feel kind of bad. Like, I need to get out there and jog. And if I felt the same way with writing, like, I need to get 1,000 words. And it was important because I focused on the 1,000 words and not, like, on whatever I was writing. Because I think the writer's block thing comes when you're sitting at your desk and thinking, like, I don't know where to go. I don't know how to get, you know, from A to B. But if you just kind of commit to a word count, you are letting yourself go and you're trying to get to that word count. And I thought about it as, like, I just need enough sand. I just need enough sand. I'll build a castle later on. But if I don't have sand, I can't build a castle. So for me, writing 1,000 words a night was like getting the sand out there. And then later on, I can shape this into something that's meaningful.
I think that's right. I mean, they say, don't get it right, get it written.
Yeah.
And then one last question, we'll take it here.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to first just thank you for your vulnerability and openness tonight. It's definitely really resonated with me. So to start off, I would love to hear about the intention behind having mental health play a role in this novel. As like other novels I've read, like Freshwater, Transcendent Kingdom, like that's coming out more and more. And as a Nigerian immigrant myself, it's really inspiring to see younger authors who are really sort of very just putting it out there and like having this, like giving a voice to this missing voice in a lot of these stories. And then one more plug to say to you. So I was a student back in 2013 in her class.
Yeah.
And I like was here when you did the King Prize and a lot of your writings like really resonated. So it's really great to just be full circle.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for coming out again. It's so good to see you again. And I really appreciate the question as well. I think in my case, like, so I dealt with that. My mom, as I mentioned before, was sick, and it was like the big secret in my family's life. And I think, like most immigrants, and in particular Nigerian immigrants, like I was taught to project perfection into the world, and I did that for as long as I could. And I just found it to be a really injurious thing to myself. Like I wasn't being honest with myself about why, you know, why do I feel this way? Why do I have these dark nights of the soul? Like it's because I wasn't dealing with that. And so I think, you know, for me, the process of writing about how difficult it was, how that thing, that disease destroyed our family for a few years and we managed to kind of rebuild, but it's still this thing that we kind of like navigate around and don't necessarily talk about. It's out there. And I think as I spoke to more people, you know, in the similar position, other children of immigrants, other children of Nigerian immigrants, that I saw that we were having similar conversations about our, like even the most sort of ostensibly perfect seeming families had these deep, dark secrets that they weren't reckoning with. And mental illness was a part of it. And I think when I think about my mom's, what happened to my mom, I think there was something around her, like kind of big dreams and ambitions about America and slamming into the wall repeatedly that maybe contributed to her sort of really difficult period. And so I thought there was something there to write about. Like, what does it mean to have this, like, really, you know, in her case, like, dreaming about America, listening to the Beatles or whatever. They're not an American band, but for her, she's associated with America. Watching these American shows, coming here, and having every part of who you are rejected constantly. Like, what does that do to a person? How does that mess you up? I was about to say another word, but, you know, how does that mess you up, right? It messes you up in all kinds of ways. And I think the one thing that I have in this sort of system that still repudiates parts of me all the time is that, you know, my parents raised me with a sense of, you know, confidence and belief in myself and everything else. But what happens when you don't have those things when you come here and you come here expecting that you'll be treated, you know, like people will take you, sort of take you seriously because you're a person and you're not even considered a person. And so I thought, here's a place where I can write, you know, here's something that I can discuss that, and in so doing, and I think it's one reason that my dad probably hasn't read the book because he's heard what it's about and he doesn't want to go back there. It was a really difficult period. But I think before I could sort of leap on to write about whatever else I wanted to write about, and before I could consider myself an artist who is fully engaging with the world, I had to get that out of me. So, and you're right, there's an entire, a lot of folks that I deeply admire, some of whom I know quite well, are also writing. And we have conversations about this as well. And they fortified me also. I remember I was in a really difficult place and I sent off a text to my, you know, secret African WhatsApp group. And I said, I don't know if I should do this. And like, yeah, just do it, just do it. So I did it. So I think it's really important to kind of be, because the writing that's resonated with me has been the most vulnerable writing, the most writing that interrogates those private spaces. And I thought, like, I have to offer this of myself if I want the writing to resonate as well.
Wonderful.
Thank you for the question.
Thank you very much indeed. That's the last one. So join us for a drink afterwards and get your books signed. They're on sale outside. Have a bag of crisps. And say thank you to Toby for Lauren.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
That was Toby for Lauren, reading at the Lannan Center at Georgetown University. Look out for forthcoming Lannan Center podcasts by visiting lannan.georgetown.edu. For now, goodbye.